interview that's going to go along with King Biscuit Flower Hour Bachman Turner Overdrive performance of March 8th, 1974. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but 1974 was a great year for Bachman Turner Overdrive.
Yeah, that was 74 and 75 were the two, you know, really great peak years.
Mm. Can you tell me what it was like during that time?
Well, I had been there before with the Guess Who, and the other guys in my band were, you know, quite green at the music business, and I kept saying to them, you won't believe it when it happens, you know, because you struggle no matter how, you know, you struggle for a certain period of time with a band. It could be years or many, many, many years, and these guys, the dream is more obscure to them than it was with me. I knew that it was attainable, and then when it kind of happened, it's just like you're walking and traveling around in a dream, in a daze. It's like it's just like you're dreaming and you don't wake up. So everything is really quite abnormal. It's surreal. You know, everywhere you go, everyone suddenly knows who you are. You're playing the same set that you played a year or two before. Instead of people being indifferent or playing to 10 people in a club, you're suddenly playing to, you know, 10, 20,000 people. The same set, same song, and the reaction is just totally opposite.
Mm. Why do you think that happens, that what at one point was merely background music becomes the foreground for somebody's life and they embrace it so strongly?
Oh, I just think it's a matter of exposure. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, exposure just isn't the key element. It's being at the right place at the right time. And in order to be at the right place at the right time, you need to have that exposure. You need to be there. And I remember the first year of BTO, we toured over 300 days in that first year. We toured, and to get the exposure, we had a really good agent, and our record label was kind of backing us, covering any expenses, because it's very expensive. Like, we'd go from Portland to Texas, and then up to back to Seattle, and over to Chicago, wherever we were getting radio airplay. We got added onto a show, and we'd be playing gigs with Peter Frampton, Foghat, Doobie Brothers, Beach Boys, ZZ Top, REO, Speedwagon, Aerosmith, all the guitar kind of based bands that were just kind of, I guess, just getting started, but really changing the music of the 70s.
Mm. Now, there's also an element of luck involved, and I've heard a story that I would love for you to repeat, that when you put out a demo for what would become BTO's first album, it was rejected all over the place. Eventually it was accepted at Mercury Records, but there was a story about how, was it Charlie Fock, is that his name?
Fash.
Charlie Fash found your demo. Could you repeat that story for me?
Well, BTO tape got, I sent it around for almost a year and a half to over 26 labels and got refusals. And I would read in Billboard magazine or Cashbox that so-and-so had left a certain label and someone else took his job. So I would resubmit to the same label sometimes twice in a year because the A&R person would have changed. And I sent it to Charlie Fash and at Mercury Records. And I got a refusal in about, well, I guess, February. And I was very downtrodden because I knew him. He was one of my last hopes, and I got a standard letter saying they were passing on the project. And I then notified the band, who I had them all on salary with my, you know, my meager earnings from the guests who was supporting BTO at the time and paying for the, you know, the studio costs and the sessions and everything. And I notified them that I had about 2 weeks of money left, and then suddenly they were all off salary and they had to go and get the dreaded day jobs, right? And about 2 days before the end of the week when the money was going to run out, the phone rang and it was Charlie Fash from Chicago. And I could hear, "Give Me Your Money, Please," playing in the background. And I knew that was the first song on the tape. Then you sent out 2 7.5-inch reels of your album, you know, A side and a B side. And I could hear side one, cut one. He said, "Randy, this tape is fabulous. Is the rest of the tape like this?" And I said, "Yeah, it's kind of all the same. It's just, you know, good old dancing rock and roll." And he said, "Well, I think you have a deal. I'm going to take it to our A&R meeting this coming Saturday in L.A. and play it for everyone there. As far as I'm concerned, this is great, and I want to sign it." And I flipped through my pages, and I looked, and I said, "Charlie, you passed on this in February." Now, he's calling me now in April. Mm-hmm. So you passed on this in February. He looked through his records. And he said, oh, I was in MeDem in France, and I had somebody in my office whose name was Bud Scapa, who's now the head of Sire. You probably have heard of him.
Yes,
And Bud Scapa had been hired as a junior guy to do some promotion and marketing for bands, and basically to clear out the offices. So he had sent everyone a pass letter, maybe without even hearing the tape, just a standard, you know, rejection letter. And Charlie Fasher's gotten back from his trip to meet them in France, and he was coming back to kind of clear off his desk and just throw everything away and start the new year, because most record guys start the new year kind of March and April. Once they get back, they get their new budget, and they, you know, they have their sights set on what they're going to do for the following year. And as he was clearing everything off of his desk, literally just an armful, just sliding everything off the desk into a big trash box, one tape missed the trash box and fell on the floor. And as he went to pick it up separately, he saw my name in big red letters I had written on the 7.5-inch white box, you know, B-A-C-H-M-A-N in red marker pen. And he thought, oh, I remember meeting him, last year, and said, if you ever got anything to send it to me. He played it, and he was calling me as he was playing it, hearing the first song. So there is that element of luck there, of these things happen, which you basically have no control over.
Yeah, it's a great story. I know Tom Scholz of Boston has told me how every single label he sent the first Boston record to passed on it, including Epic.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. It's interesting how it all falls into place eventually. Now, falling into place, we've got a track list here that I would like to go over, because I think these songs had a lot to do with the success of BTO in the studio and on the road. Tell me about how you wrote the song Let It Ride.
Well, the first BTO album was basically what you did in the early 70s, and that is an album like Led Zeppelin. They did an album, and they didn't want any singles. So the first BTO album was basically what I thought. Each song was a great rock song, but nothing really had the format or the sound to really get top 40 airplay or therefore be a single. And the label, Charlie Fatch, called me and said, you know, you sold a million albums. This thing's been on the chart for a long time. It's going to be on for another long time. But go back to your Guess Who roots and write something commercial, like put together something that's really radio friendly.
Mm-hmm.
I was touring down in the States. Like I said, we were opening for, I guess, ZZ Top at that time, way down south. I think we were in New Orleans. And I heard a truck driver say, a trucker had cut somebody off on the road. And then he was being accosted. He was accosting the trucker at the next truck stop, saying, you cut me off, you miserable so-and-so, you got to have some road manners. The truck driver just looked at him and said, no big deal, buddy, just let it ride.
Mm.
Like kids say now, chill out. And so I thought, wow, great title, Let It Ride. And I had these couple of chords that were from Anton Dvorak's Piano Concerto in D, off of a piano, and I'm playing them on guitar, and that was the beginning to Let It Ride. So when we got to New Orleans, I got Turner in a room, and I said, you know, here's some chord ideas for a song, and here's the title, Let It Ride, and let's throw something together. And we wrote it in our hotel room, I think just before Mardi Gras one year, and it was literally written in like 10, 15 minutes.
Was that a traditional concert opener?
Yes, because of the, once it got radio airplay, because of the recognizable guitar chords, which is very hard to do in this day and age. I mean, chords are chords, but there seems to be something about that progression that's very recognizable, like China Grove or something, you know, by the Doobie Brothers. There's that, play a couple of chords and it's really recognizable.
So that was a great way to open up a show.
Yes.
Now the second song on the set list here is Give It Time, and for me, that reminded me a little bit of a mountain.
Yeah, both Turner and myself were big mountain fans. When BTO first started, we did a lot of songs from that first Mountain album. We were big fans of Leslie West and, you know, Mississippi Queen, that whole type of sound. And that was kind of Turner doing a Leslie West, mountain bass riff. And you can certainly hear me paying tribute to Leslie's lead guitar and some of my licks I'm playing in there.
Now, on this particular record, who plays the riff and who takes, like, the first solo?
I'm doing all the solo guitar, and all of us together are just playing the riff. It's like two guitars, bass, and drums playing that. Just playing that mountain kind of riff.
Mm. And did that have any particular significance in the live set?
The running of the King Biscuit show was pretty much our live set at the time. We didn't change it for the radio show. And after the recognizable Let It Ride, which had its chords and might have seemed somewhat a lighter song because of all the harmony, suddenly we went into this thundering tom-tom snare guitar bass riff thing, and we would do that riff over and over and over until we started the singing. So we'd do get 30, 40, 50 seconds of that low, heavy riff, and it would get the crowd clapping and stomping, and then we were off into the song.
Yeah, sort of letting them know, hey, we're a rock band.
Yeah, we're here to, we mean business, and, you know, we're here to rock.
Now, Roll On Down the Highway, what was the story of writing that one?
Well, somehow, I guess with the name Overdrive, which we got from the Truckers magazine, none of us were like the boy next door, a model type of kid. We were the boy next door, football kind of husky kind of guy. And so we got known as kind of the average guy or the blue-collar band or the truck-driving, you know, kind of guys. And our songs ended up being like Let It Ride, coming from a trucker's term, and then Taking Care of Business being kind of a generic kind of trucker's term. We started to have songs about rolling down the highway and four-wheel drive and, you know, different like that. So it was almost like the Beach Boys got a surfing kind of and car kind of thing. BTO got kind of a truck driving kind of thing. So Rolling Down the Highway, just a standard song written about and for people driving in their cars. I mean, people used to tell me that BTO was great dashboard music, and that they would play it in the car and they'd play drums on the dash of their car and be singing along. It was very easy to sing along to, and that just kind of became the theme of the band.
Right. This song also had two parts to it, a distinctive, what I called sort of Creedence or Chuck Berry-inspired verse, and then it opens up with this cool riff at the chorus.
Yeah, I made up that riff, and it's kind of, dare I say, kind of like Heart, Crazy on You,
mm-hmm.
That Heart thing.
Right.
Gee, that was such a great thing, the way Wilson was screaming Crazy on You, and this guitar riff was going da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, against it, underneath it. And so we put a similar thing there. We're yelling Let It Roll, and the guitar is playing that low riff, and it kind of carries what you're screaming through, if you know what I mean. It gives a great foundation to what you're yelling, and that was basically the hook of the song, Let It Roll Down the Highway.
And it was also a song for jamming.
Yeah, I think it was a real jam kind of song. And I've heard people singing that, like they don't know who I am. I'm walking through the park or something. I hear them singing it. One person singing Let It Roll, and the other one's going, da, 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 you know, kind of jamming, even doing air mouth guitar.
Right, but for you, it was also a guitar piece.
Yeah, I did the solo in that a lot of people said is like the perfect guitar solo, in that how it builds and progresses and goes higher and higher and higher. To me, it was just a standard solo. I try to do them all that way, because if you start high on a guitar, there's nowhere else to go. So you kind of start low and slow, and you kind of, you know, build it to some sort of peak and crescendo. But it's fun to always play that solo live. Most people know it, and they all play air guitar to it live.
Mm. So that was an intentional sort of high point for the show.
Yeah, Let It Ride became, you know, as the years went by, it became near the end of our set.
Mm-hmm.
Became a thing that, you know, because we'd start out with a standard, you know, Let It Ride and things like that. And then Roll On Down the Highway went to the end of the set just before Taking Care of Business, because it was a powerhouse driving song. And you want the crowd to a fever pitch when you go off stage. You want to be brought back for your encore.
Right. Now, Welcome Home is an interesting shift. I've done some homework and realized that your first guitar teacher was the magnificent Lenny Bro.
Yeah, he was fabulous. So if you listen to Blue Collar on the first BTO album, that's all pretty much what Lenny Bro inspired in me to do as far as jazzy kind of guitar playing. And then it came through again in Welcome Home. The ending on that is pretty much kind of a standard jazz comp thing that is either Howard Roberts or Barney Kessel that Lenny Bro was playing and showed me at the time. And then the next, and later on BTO, we did Looking Up for Number One. That's a very similar guitar, jazz-based kind of, you know, other bands did blues, slow blues as their kind of pace, change of pace. BTO, we did the, kind of those jazzy things.
Right. It was also a wonderful time in music when everyone would accept the fact that Welcome Home has a jazzy octave light element And then toward the end of the song, you get this, you rock out. Also, kind of reminded me of Boris the Spider, that descending riff.
Yeah, I don't know if that would get any airplay in this day and age. Then it was, you know, the early 70s was wide open. It was just kind of coming out of the late 60s where bands would really jam on stage, and suddenly that jamming was being accepted on albums, like in the Allman Brothers albums, long extended cuts, and Jefferson Airplane, and so we kind of did that on albums, and some of them even became singles, and suddenly there was, you know, a 4-minute single on the radio with some jamming in it, and extended jamming, not a little 8-bar, 12-bar solo, you know, a whole ending tacked onto the end of a single that had some really good playing, rather than something simple that you got to play in 8 bars.
Mm. It was, Welcome Home was really an early fusion song.
Yeah, and it was also very autobiographical. That was us, after those 300 days on the road, I wrote that song, Get Up in the Morning and Rush to Catch a Plane, Living in Your Suitcase, Back on the Road Again. I mean, that's really an autobiographical thing of what we were going through at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And how good it is to get home. You come home, play the same club, and you play the same songs. Play the same club, the same song, same set, you know, a year later. And it's jammed, and people are going crazy because they've heard it on the radio and they bought it on record. Whereas the year before, they were hearing them as green, virgin songs, you know, in a club, and they had no recognition of them.
Mm. And then, of course, I'm guessing that the finale song of a standard show would be Taking Care of Business before the encore.
It was then, because we felt a certain energy then in the crowd, and now it is the standard encore song, and it's kind of an anthem.
Mm.
Turned into something more than what it ever was.
Well, originally it was called The White Collar Worker.
Yeah, I wrote that to kind of copy the Beatles' paperback writer. And it's very much in that format. And if you listen to the lyrics and the verses of Taking Care of Business, they describe the day in the life of a, you know, just a working guy. And paperback writer would describe the day in the life of a guy who wrote paperback writers and books and novels. And when it got to my hook, just as it did in Paperback Writer, where they went, Paperback Writer, in mine, we stopped the music and all went, White Collar Worker, you know, like a Beatles thing. And it was terrible, and nobody liked it. But I knew the verses were good. And one day, going to a club, heard a DJ on the radio say, this is C Fox Radio in Vancouver, and we're taking care of business. And he played a track by someone else, and I thought, gee, that's a good title for a song, Taking Care of Business. And that night was a Saturday night. I got to the club, and C.F. Turner, who had been singing all week, you know, in a rock and roll club. I think we did 5 sets a night, 6 nights a week. So it was Saturday, and he'd pretty much been screaming for a whole week. And he lost his voice in the last set. And he came and said, I can't sing, I can't even talk, you got to sing the last set. So here I was kind of forced into singing the last set. So after we did Oyo Como Va and Down by the River and all kind of non-singing songs, like She Belongs to Me, the way Rick Nelson did it, the Dylan thing, suddenly, I had run out of songs that I used to kind of sing to give him a rest on stage. And I turned around and said to them, follow me, here's a brand new song in 3 chords over and over, like Louie, just play these 3 chords over and over. I want to get to the hook, help me. And they said, how can we help you? We don't even know it. And the crowd is yelling rock and roll. It's midnight on a Saturday, and I started playing it, and I sang the verses. And I don't know how, but when it got to the choruses, I didn't say White Collar Worker, I said Taking Care of Business. And the next time we got to it in the song, they sang it. They sensed it coming. They sang Taking Care of Business. And then I answered them every day, Taking Care of Business, every way. And when the song was over, the crowd knew we were kind of jamming. There was such an energy and electricity coming off the stage. The crowd kept clapping and singing Taking Care of Business. And when we went to record 2 weeks later, it was kind of amazing that I wrote it, the lyrics, and gave them to Turner. And he said, what are these for? And I said, well, how do you know the words to these songs? He said, I'm not going to sing this song. I want you to sing it. And you'll be singing a real song of ours, of your own, on record, and give me a rest on stage. And I said, okay, so I sang it. It was kind of the first time I really sang anything, even though at the time I think I had a sore throat or something, throat problem. I sound very adenoidal on that track. But and as it turned out, I was just finishing it up, and it wasn't really sounding that good. And there was a knock at the door in the studio. We opened the door, and there was a great big guy, probably 6'6", 300 pounds, standing there in army fatigues with an army hat with a big beard. He looked like Fidel Castro. And this is like 1973, I guess, and Castro, and this is what he looked like. And he was in the news a lot, and it was a shock to us to see this big guy there. And he said, did anyone order the pizza? And he had like 4 pizzas in his hand. And we said, no, it's not us. It must be down the hall. And down the hall, Steve Miller was recording, and the group War. And so he went, you know, he stood there and listened to taking care of business. And he went down and delivered his pizza. He came back and knocked on the door again. He said, do you have a piano player? And I said, no. And he said, that song sounds like you could really use a piano. And I said, well, it's 2 a.m. and we're going home. Are you a piano player? He said, yeah, give me a shot. So he took out a napkin and wrote down the chords and when the song stopped and started. And we gave him one take on the, record, and he left. And when Charlie Fatch came from the record label, he came in, he said, wow, this is great, a piano. It makes you guys sound like more than two guitars, bass, and drums. It's really a great different texture to hear on your record. Who's the piano player? And I said, I don't know. He was delivering pizza. Then we had to do some detective work, and for a couple of days, call every pizza place in the Yellow Pages in Seattle and find out if they had a big, tall guy who looked like Fidel Castro. Long story short, we found him and gave him credit. His name was Norman Durkee. He went on, I think, to become Bette Midler's music director on one of her national tours. And then he went on to being a pianist for the Los Angeles Philharmonic or the LA Symphony or something like that, where he still is today.
That's wild. So what does You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet seem to mean to the... actually, we'll get to that in a moment. What does taking care of business mean to the crowd when you play it in the set? Is there an energy surge there?
It means everything to everybody. Depending on your age, I've heard people use that to refer to actually what it is, taking care of business, you know, don't mess around, you know, do your job, you know, put in your time, you know, be successful at your job, make your money and go home. I've heard other people use it for making out, like, you know, let's take care of some business here. I've heard these all different connotations. Little kids use it in hockey and in sports. You get a touchdown, you score a goal, and everyone yells, yeah, that's taking care of business. So it's turned out to be, you know, to mean many, many things. And when I play it, even to this day in the audience, to see all ages reacting to that song and knowing that song, and one of the most touching things I got was regarding that song was on my answering machine about 8 or 9 months ago, and somebody just got my number and called me out of the blue and said they were working with children, disturbed children in a hospital. What's it called? What are these people? What was Rain Man? What's that called?
Autistic.
But they're working with autistic children and very withdrawn children that they couldn't communicate with. They started out every morning playing Taking Care of Business, and these little kids clapped to it because it was such a simple clapping song, and the kids actually sang or mumbled that phrase, and it broke down barriers between the teacher and them and allowed the teacher to communicate with them for 5 or 10 minutes, which was a lifetime to these teachers because these kids just wouldn't respond any other way. Mm. And that they started every day playing this song as the good morning, let's get going kind of phrase. And that was very touching to me, that the song went beyond rocking and rolling and had a deeper purpose of communication.
That's wonderful. Now, I'm supposing that the first encore was usually Slow Down Boogie.
Yes, because when people don't know your material, you just put your most boogiest crowd getting song. You know, everyone would respond to a boogie like that. It's like a canned heat thing, right? You know, so
right.
That was kind of our encore thing, and out of it came another song that Turner wrote on the first album, Thank You for the Feeling. And you know, we're so grateful to get an encore, because when you're starting out, nobody knows any of your material. You go out and play brand new stuff to them for 45 or 60 minutes. And so we ended up, our encore was, you know, Slow Down Boogie, and that kind of evolved into Thank You for the Feeling.
And also, Slow Down Boogie, are you playing slide guitar?
No, that's Blair Thornton.
Okay.
He was the other guitarist in the band. And so I was like holding the rhythm together, playing the other lead. He played all the slide in BTO.
And you played the unaccompanied guitar solo when it went into that rock and roll section.
Yes, right.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the evolution of You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet.
Well, that was on the BTO third album. And when I would produce the band in those days, I didn't even have a cassette player. So I never really knew what anything would sound like. And so when we went into the studio, I wanted to record the band tracks, you know, the really live and get a really live feel, just like we were in a club. So I'd actually set the band up in the studio as if we were on a stage, you know, in a club, rather than normal studio setup. And I wanted to have a work song that we worked on. So I would play it with the band, the engineer would record it, and I'd run into the control room and listen to the bass and guitar and drum sounds. We'd go out and move microphones around and try to get, you know, the sounds that I wanted. And I had a work song, so we would play through it maybe 5 or 6 times. And then when we started the real songs for the album, and we would never do the work song again, we'd start the real songs. They'd be fresh, and we wouldn't have done them 5 or 6 or 10 times in trying to get a bass or a snare sound. So I had this work song that didn't even really have a title, and it was this jangling guitar, which was very light, and then a heavy middle part. And I specifically had a song like that so I could judge the heavy riff sounds we were getting and the lighter, more rhythmic sounds that we were playing. And so I just sang a vocal on that, kind of made anything up, and I stuttered through the ending because I had a younger brother who stuttered. And me being the oldest, I used to tease him all the time, which is what older brothers do. They have this cruel streak. And so I always teased my younger brother for stuttering. And I thought I would just mix this track and send it to him, and no one else would ever hear this track. And then we went on to proceed and record the other 8 tracks for the album. And when Charlie Fash, who at that time, you know, became our mentor, he's the one who signed us, and he'd always come to our album sessions and help us direct me which songs really needed work as far as being singles. And what he left alone is just he knew I was doing good album cuts and stuff. He flew in and he heard the album, the Not Fragile album. He said, you know, there's some really good songs in there, but I'm looking for something better than Let It Ride and Taking Care of Business, which were our 2 singles. He said, I don't hear this track to take you higher on Top 40 radio. You're selling millions of albums. That's great. But we want to crack this Top 40 market. And I said, well, all we have on here is Rolling Down the Highway. And he said, that's a good song, but it's not like a Top 40 kind of song. And the engineer poked me and he said, play him the work track. And we were all stunned. And I said, you got to be kidding. He said, no, play it. There's magic in there. So I played this work track, and Charlie Fast jumped out of his chair saying, it's a monster, it's a hit. And I said, you got to be kidding. I'm singing off flat and sharp. I wasn't even concentrating on singing. And I'm stuttering, doing this thing where I'm kind of making fun of my brother. He said, it's a monster, leave it. And I said, no, I want to come back tomorrow and try it out. And so I came back the next morning, and I tried singing it straight, and it was kind of stupid. It sounded like Tony Bennett or Frank Sinatra going, baby, you ain't seen nothing yet. And it just didn't fit. And Charlie said, look, leave the stuttering in. Believe me, it's going to be a hit. So we left it in, and I squeezed it on the album. That's the first BTO album that had 9 songs, because I had put the work song on there.
Now, was it inspired by The Who? I mean, was there a...
No, it was truly inspired by Dave Mason, Only You Know and I Know. The rhythm chords in that, the beginning is pretty much the same. When it got to the hook, I never thought of The Who, and I never thought of stuttering like my generation. I was stuttering because I was kind of making fun of my brother, and no one was supposed to hear this. I was just going to mix it, send it to my brother back in Winnipeg, saying, here, we did this just for you, you know.
And how did it go over live?
Fabulous. People loved it. I think that's why Charlie Fetch must have liked it in the first place. It was done without any contrivance or planning. It was just a very happy song, and the rhythm track was just very happy and sounded great on Top 40 radio. I mean, I'm headed to London next week to re-record this track with 2 new artists in England who are doing a new, I don't know, rock, dance, hip-hop, rap version of this song. So the song's living on.
That's great. Now, at the time you recorded this, did you have a knowledge of what King Biscuit Flower Hour was?
Yes, I'd heard about it, and I'd heard it when we were touring in the States, and you kind of have this envy in you. How come this band is doing it, and we're not doing it? Why isn't anyone asking us to do this? How do we get to do this show? You know, it's like Don Kirshner's rock concert, similar thing on television. You want to do this show that everyone else is doing, that's so cool, and it's pretty much, you're naked. It's live. There's no overdubs. It is what you are. And out of the blue, we got a call from our agent saying, the King Biscuit Flower Power wants to do you, and is this date okay? And I don't even remember where we were, somewhere in the Northeast. And we said, yeah, and we just went ahead and did it. And it was great. Hearing the tape now, I wish I could do a little bit of touch-up on it. But that's what the show was. It was live. I mean, everyone's so used to touching up live tapes these days.
Yeah, you know what this reminded me of? The other day I went out and bought Roadwork by Edgar Winter.
Yeah.
And there's a certain energy that is on this tape. It's also on Roadwork. That's spontaneous and naked and raw, and everything that rock should be. It should be, you know, you're sweating, you're not well buttoned in your tie.
Yes, and I think it's because there's an audience there, and you're trying to get them off of their feet. I mean, when we used to play, like you said, Edgar Winter, Doobie Brothers, you know, Frampton, BTO, ZZ Top, you did not want those people sitting on chairs like the old high school dancers. You wanted them up and boogieing and dancing. And so there's this tension there where you're putting everything into them. You're trying to communicate with them right off the bat that you can hear in a live take. You're trying to get that audience on your side and get them up dancing and screaming and grooving. And you can't get that when you're in the studio. It's you sitting alone on a chair trying to be cool, but you're missing that kind of tension or the reaching out of the, you know, trying to communicate with the crowd. And I think it's there on the live tape.